Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I've been talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed at our club night, as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, I'm delighted to welcome the comedian and broadcaster Ellis James. A fluent Welsh speaker, he incorporates his heritage, love of football, history and culture into his stand-up. He currently co-hosts the Ellis James and John Robbins show on BBC Sounds, as well as the Socially Distant Sports Bar and Oh What a Time podcasts. Hello, Ellis, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
So, we first met, I think, at an Adwaith gig that I was promoting at the Lexington.
I remember the gig very well because it was the first gig I'd attended after lockdown.
Oh, wow.
So it was the first room I'd been in with lots of people because I'd gone to a football match in the like Capital One Cup, Reading away or something with Swansea. And it was one of those things where because of the nature of the fixture, there weren't that many people there anyway. So it didn't feel particularly full on. Coming out of lockdown and obviously being worried about getting COVID. And then they lifted all the restrictions. Everything was technically back to normal. And you think, okay, yeah, great. Yeah, I love Adwaith. I'm gonna go to the gig. I'm gonna go to the show. That'll be fine. And then I remember turning up at the Lexington, which obviously is quite small. I thought, oh my God, it's disease central. And then, but they were brilliant and it was great to meet you. And then I went to a football match. I went to watch Swansea City play Bristol City and it was full. I was in the away end and I didn't die. And I thought, this is okay. But with Adwaith, what was so great about them was I hadn't had a chance to see them prior to lockdown, but I'd loved the records. And I read an interview with them in, I think it might be The Guardian, where they were talking about their process during lockdown. They're sending each other voice notes and things on their iPhones. And so to see them live in London and the place was full and they were a band I'd been keeping an eye on for a long time anyway, it was a very memorable gig for lots of different reasons.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've DJed at Scared to Dance a bunch of times, both at the Shackle Arms and the Victoria in Dalston. So I know you're a huge music fan, and what I'd like to do is try really dig into your music collection. What would have been the first song that a young Ellis James would have heard? Can you remember that far back?
When I was very little, it would be stuff like, I mean, the really significant songs from when I was very little would be things like Paul McCartney's Frog Chorus, Amazing. Band-Aid, Ernie the Fastest Milkman in the West, and also stuff my parents were listening to. So my mum was a big Rod Stewart fan and had a Rod Stewart Greatest Hits that we used to have in the car. I remember my mother dancing with my little sister who'd just been born in the kitchen to Rod Stewart. So I think Rod Stewart, and then a little bit after that, we had a Beatles cassette. I remember on family holidays, we used to listen to the Beatles. And I didn't particularly like them then. They're now the most significant, or one of the most significant musical forces in my life. But then I sort of thought it was mum and dad music. And then by the time I got to sort of, I don't know, probably seven, I was a big fan of Kylie and Jason Donovan, who I'd been introduced to, of course, through Neighbours, the soap opera. And I mean, Kylie obviously was an actress in a soap opera. And now it's just this huge pop phenomenon with a 35 plus year, you know, career. But yeah, my sister and I bought those albums. We used to share them on cassette. So, and I had a very poppy taste until slightly later than some of my friends. Actually, I was thinking about this. Yeah, I bought M People's Elegant Slumming, which won the Mercury Prize. Yeah, I bought Now Dance 93. Yeah, I bought, I was a big fan of the Now albums. It's a lot of fun watching my daughter discover music now because she's very open to new stuff and she really loves music. And she's got this strange taste that's an amalgam of Six Music Dad. Like she's a big fan of Pavement and My Bloody Valentine. And she likes the Beatles. She likes Dinosaur Jr.
Of course.
But also she's 10. So she likes Olivia Rodrigo's her big one. And The fascinating thing that's different to growing up in 2025 as opposed to sort of 1985 or 1995 is that if there's a song I think of that I think she'll like, I can play it immediately. And also, sometimes she'll come back and she'll just, so she'll have heard something on the playground, and it will just be a snippet of a lyric, which I then Google, find, and we can instantly play it, and it goes onto the list. Whereas with the Now records, obviously, even if I was a big singles buyer because it was so cheap, because you could buy it, if you bought a cassette single the week of release when I first started buying music, they were 99 pence. You could kind of stretch that. And then second week of release, they would go to 199. So I had to be a bit more careful with my money. But if you listened to Radio 1 a lot, as I did, you were kind of ready for them to be released, and then you'd have that money ready to go. And I still have a little bit of pocket money. So I was buying a sort of single a week when I was about her age. So the Now albums, absolute gold dust, because you get that for your birthday, and it's like 40 songs, and you probably like 37 of them, because that's the way kids are.
But there was a great thing about it. You could, you know, it was a sort of, you could mix and match approach and sort of getting to different genres as well.
Well, I've got this theory that when I was a teenager, in the pre-streaming age, certainly, if you're a big music fan, your music collection kind of defined your personality. It said more about me than the stuff I said, really, my music collection. And I remember going to see a gig, and I'd bought Staring at the Sea, the Cure singles, 1979 to 86, that day. I remember saying to my friend Rodri, I've now got 40 CDs. That's the 40th CD. Whereas now, we kind of, apart from the stuff that's not available to stream, and there is, you know, it is still about, in the main, we kind of all share the same record collection. It's just whether you've bothered to search for it and click on it yet. So I think that's, it's slightly taken the defining characteristics of music in terms of your personality have been lost a little bit. But I think it's better, because I love the fact that if I hear something on the radio, just maybe like, this is insane, right? 15-year-old me, or even 20-year-old me, would have been absolutely blown away by this. You hear the last 10 seconds of a song, you think, oh, that sounds quite interesting. You Shazam it, so then you instantly know what it is. And then it's on your phone, and then you have that song forever. It's like something out of sci-fi. It doesn't make it... How does Shazam work? Shazam has been around for years. How does it work?
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, I mean, I remember... You know, recording things off of Radio One, because you would get the DJ.
Didn't want to hear Mark Goodyear's voice. See a pressing stop just as he starts queuing up the next tune. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've touched upon your early musical memories. So what, with your prized pocket money, what was the first album that you bought?
The first album I bought was 10 Good Reasons by Jason Donovan.
Wow.
The first single I bought was a few years later, and that was, this says so much about my personality, it was Everything I Do It For You by Bryan Adams, which famously was at number one for, I think, 16 weeks and broke the record.
It was forever, yeah.
So it was, I think it broke Slim Whitman's record from memory. I've not looked that up, but I think he'd been at number one for about 11 weeks, and Bryan Adams broke that record. So say it was number one for 16 weeks. I think I bought it in, like, week 15, because I was like, okay, I want to be a part of a movement. I want to be part of the movement that keeps this guy at number one forever, because this is a new story.
That was the feeling behind it, was it? To join in and not feel left out.
I liked the song. I didn't want to feel left out. And then I went to watch the film in the cinema. And I, growing up in a small town, there wasn't that much stuff for kids to do. So the cinema really was it. So I went to watch the film in the cinema. And I remember an older friend pointing out that everyone was staying behind to listen to the song. Like, that's so, I don't know if it was number one for an equivalent amount of time in other countries, but in the UK, people became utterly obsessed with that tune. And it's not that good. I think Bryan Adams has written better songs. It's not even the best Bryan Adams song.
Baby When You're Gone is really good.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't a number one for 3 months, was it?
So, okay, so knowing you as I do, I wouldn't say that was representative of your music taste. So at what point did perhaps you find your little home or your niche that you felt slightly more comfortable with? Would it have been something that your sister was listening to or your friends at school?
It was. It would have initially been Britpop, but I think I came to that quite late. I was slightly, ever so slightly too young for Nirvana. Even though I say that, there were kids in my year who loved Nirvana. I was just too immature for Nirvana when Kurt was still alive. So I think I bought Unplugged, which was released quite quickly after his death, I think. I bought that and listened to that to death and thought it was amazing. But I remember Some Might Say, which went to number one, the Oasis single, came out in around April 95, and I wasn't actually a massive fan. I thought it was a bit heavy, actually. I was like, oh, I don't know about that. And then that summer, we went to London on holiday, and we went to HMV on Oxford Street, and I bought Definitely Maybe on a whim and listened to it, and it really connected me on quite a deep level. And I was like, okay, I'm all in on this kind of stuff now. So then when Morning Glory came out in the October, I was absolutely ready and I bought it on the day of release. And around that time as well, I discovered Gorky's Exotic Monkey. And I was introduced to them before most people of my age because they'd gone to my school. So they were in the upper sixth form when I was in year seven. And my mother worked with Eros Charles, the singers, and the violinist Megan Childs' mother. The Gorkys, I remember them in school, and you know, my mother obviously was friends with the singer and the violinist's mum, and they started off right singing largely in Welsh, and so there was a very, very significant, really, really influential Welsh language music programme called Video Now. So I saw them on that, and then their single Merchyn Eu Gwallt Eu Gilydd, which is absolutely fantastic song. I DJ'd a couple of weeks ago and played it to end, and it sounds so good, really loud. But I remember that went into the Welsh language top 10, and we were doing a school thing, and it was being rained off, probably, which is a very Welsh anecdote. So we were all sent into like the TV room, and we were just made to watch telly for a bit until our parents came to pick us up. So they turned on the Welsh language chart show. And they said, you know, Gorky's in at number 10. And the girls in the sixth form, we knew them all cheered. I remember thinking, oh, I should probably pay attention to this band. And around the time when you're sort of 14 or 15 and you're developing your own identity and you're growing up into the person you're probably going to be, and you're casting aside your childish ways, they were so important because they were doing a really cool thing. And they were in, you know, they were on John Peel and they were on Mark and Lard on the Radio and Evening Show, and they're on the Evening Session, and they were in the Music Press, all that kind of stuff. And they made having a cool job, certainly being in music, seem very achievable because they had a background very similar to mine. So I thought, well, you know, if they've done it, surely that doesn't, anyone can do it. Which is if I could bottle that feeling and give it to kids, it's such a valuable thing, Matt. And also because I wouldn't say, it's not that I didn't fit in, but because I was interested in slightly different stuff to a lot of the other kids, the fact that they were so quirky and playful and imaginative, and also, I mean, especially in the English music press, painted them as sort of weirdos, Welsh weirdos. I used to think, well, I don't think they're that weird. I just think they're funny. And I really recognise this, and they make me laugh. And also such gift, you know, as a band, they had such a gift for melody. So even the very early, very psychedelic stuff, which they left behind a bit after a few albums, but the really quirky, idiosyncratic stuff, there's always a great melody there underneath the 40 tracks of backward recorders and feedback and all that kind of stuff. There's always brilliant melodies. And I went to a very, very, well, they went as well, obviously, to a very rugby school. So the last Welsh rugby captain was in my sister's class, and Stephen Jones, who played for the Wales and British Lions, was a couple of years above me. So when it's quite a rugby orientated school, and you sort of think, well, I'm you know, I only weigh 7 stone and I hate rugby. to have something else as well is really, really important. And Adwaith went to that school. So obviously I'm much older than Adwaith, but so I, you know, I'd left way before they started the school. But I always think now, if you're a if you're a kid in that school now, you think you probably, you know, you might not be aware of the Gorkies because they split up 20 years ago, but you will definitely be, you'd definitely be aware of Adwaith. And you think, Christ, well, if they can do it, then I can do it. And I think that's a very, very powerful feeling to give to a child.
So obviously they're both predominantly Welsh language bands. Well, Adwaith exclusively. I think Gorkies have switched between both. Predominantly Welsh, but have also done some in English. So did you grow up speaking Welsh as your first language or second?
Yes. So it's the language I would speak with my mum and dad and my sisters, and all my education was in Welsh because it was a very Welsh-speaking area.
So how much do you think it was the language that hooked you in, or how much do you think it was the fact that they're literally at the same school as you?
I think it was a little bit of everything. I think I was ready for a really quirky, idiosyncratic band because, you know, 14 can be quite a, it can be quite a significant age, I think. And you wanna do something, A, that's a little bit more grown up than the pop music you'd previously liked, B, that your parents probably aren't going to like. But C, it felt very real. I've always liked culture, whether it's books or films or documentaries, I've always liked them to be in a world I can relate to. And obviously the Gorkies, I could relate to them because my mum worked with his parents. And, you know, I was literally sitting at the same school desk. We had the same teachers. And what I liked about it was they were from you know, small villages in Pembrokeshire and Carmarthenshire. But they were just these sort of Captain Beefheart and Incredible String Band and Pentangle and Velvet Underground Living, sort of oddballs in the best possible sense. And so what I loved about it was it sort of said, you know, you don't have to be a certain way. And I think it's probably slightly different now because of the internet. So you can find friends and allies online. But when you were a teenager in the 90s, like I was, and you grew up in a small town, it was the people you knew at school and the people I knew playing for Carmarthentown Football Club under 14s and like my mum and dad, and that really was it. So you're like, you know, nowadays I think you could, you know, you might be, and obviously this poses different questions and challenges, but you know, you can, I think it's probably easier to meet people who think a little bit like you. Whereas back then I remember thinking, Christ, you know, This is really interesting, because I would go to the gigs and I'd feel very, very at home. And they were doing so well. They were, you know, and I loved the fact that they'd never seemed to compromise on their sound. I found that really, really creatively and culturally invigorating. And then the Super Furry Animals came along, who'd come from the same scene, from the Welsh language scene, and Catatonia as well. So suddenly there were all these bands who'd been playing gigs in my town or near my town in Welsh are suddenly on Top of the Pops and Jules Holland and all that kind of stuff and touring America and Japan. So it made having my kind of upbringing, which I think previously had probably felt quite restrictive because it was a small town, a long way from where all the action is. It made it feel like where the action was happening. So you're like, okay, this is great.
Yeah. Now, you know, obviously you broadcast in English, but In December 2024, you had your S4C special in, you know, a real primetime spot. So obviously, you know, the Welsh language thing has carried on with you, you know, that early feeling of being a teenager and, you know, seeing and hearing people that you really admire doing it in the Welsh language. And you've carried that on into your career. I just wondered if you could sort of tell us a little bit about the process of how you came about to write that show. I mean, you did it in your hometown and I think you did some tours in the run up to it as well. How was that experience?
Well, the process is the same as if you're writing a stand-up show in English. The difference is that you've got fewer places to try it out at. And if I was writing a show in English that was going to be on, I don't know, Netflix, for instance, I would have built up that show more slowly. I would have toured it properly before recording it. And then by the time I record it, I know it like the back of my hand and it's in my bones and I can just go out there and perform it. And fingers crossed, I perform it well on the night in front of a nice audience. But that's the one thing, you know, the show isn't the thing I'm worried about. Whereas in Welsh, obviously, I did 4 nights in London because there's lots of Welsh speakers living in London. But other than that, all the gigs have got to be in Wales. So it obviously involves a lot of travelling because I live in South London. So what I do is every time I get an idea, I write it in an iPhone note. And then I keep tabs on this iPhone note. And when I think the iPhone note is big enough, I approach Henry Whittaker, who runs the Machynlleth Comedy Festival, which I think is the best comedy festival in the world. And I ask to do an hour of new. And I usually, not a particularly big audience, maybe 100 people. That's the most nerve-wracking night of the year by a country mile, because I will go on there with a printed out iPhone note and I'll just read it. Fingers crossed there's something in it. So I did that in May 2024. And I think I did 53 minutes and there were enough laughs in there that made me think, okay, here we go. But I'd already signed the contract. So the show was going to be recorded in the November. So I've now got 6 months to write a show. The slight spanner in the works was I got married in August, and we had two ceremonies, one in Wales and one in London. So I was organising two weddings. So that was, you know, tricky because that was stressful and a burden on my time. So then once I got the weddings and the honeymoon out the way, then you're just going to different towns and trying the stuff out, literally reading off the back of receipts and envelopes and stuff, and I record them all, and then I listen to them, and I try and piece together a show. So then in the final week, I did the final gigs I all did in London. So I would be able to work on the show all day. I would cycle up to the London Welsh Centre in King's Cross. I would do the new version, record it, listen to it on the way, you know, listen to it when I got home, and then repeat. And the ending, so I recorded the show on the Saturday the 23rd. So I did a gig on the Friday, and the ending hadn't, on the Thursday, the ending hadn't worked. So I tweaked it on the Friday and it worked all right. But I thought to myself, I think I can do this. I think I know where I've gone wrong there. So then when I did it in Carmarthen for the show, it went on telly on Boxing Day, the ending was uncharted territory. So I I'm very good friends with Nish Kumar, and obviously Nish has, you know, made TV specials, and he used to find it hilarious because he was like, the stakes are so high. why are you doing it this way? But you just run out of towns. So yeah, it's the fourth one I've done, and the last one was the best one. I was really proud of the last one, actually. So yeah, but it's a nerve-wracking experience.
So Ellis, you have a background of playing in bands. How old were you when you first picked up a guitar?
I think I was about 15, I would say. And a lot of the kids in my year all picked up guitars at around the same sort of time. So we had those, a lot of us had like the Fender Squire Telecasters and the Fender Squire Stratocasters, because they're quite affordable. It's sort of affordable for like a birthday present or a Christmas present. And a really good friend of mine was a very, very gifted guitarist, and he had lessons, and I didn't have lessons. I was self-taught. I bought the Russ Shipman book of Teach Yourself Guitar or something, which is like a classical guitar. I didn't realise that it was kind of Spanish guitar. I just bought it from my local music shop. So I learned a few chords from that, and then he would show me things. And of the sort of, you know, I don't know, there were probably 20 kids in our year who were learning instruments. Then we're all in each other's bands and stuff. Because I think Oasis made it feel very, very doable and accessible, because, you know, Noel Gallagher didn't read music the same way that Paul McCartney didn't read music, and they hadn't gone to a stage school or anything. They hadn't, you know, they didn't even study drama they were quite, what Noel Gallagher had was a feral talent, in that he hadn't done music GCSE or anything. He just picked it up because he's got a great ear for melody. So it was a combination of them, and And I suppose Britpop, really, because the thing with Britpop is that there's the crop of bands that were around then, so you read about them, and then you read the interviews, and then you talk, and then they're talking about the bands that they find influential. And a lot of the time it was the Sex Pistols, and Noel Gallagher used to talk a lot about the Sex Pistols. Now, the Sex Pistols, say they had, 76, 77, that's less than 20 years prior to that. It felt like a different planet. Like, if you were 15 in 1995, 1976, 77, it's before I was born. And it just, even when you watch the Bill Grundy chat show, the grading on the TV just looks different. It just looks like ancient history. But the exciting thing with the Sex Pistols was that they're so easy to play. They're really great songs, but they're so easy to play. So all just felt very accessible. Whereas with pop music, because it was all done in studios with expensive, equipment, that didn't feel accessible. And also, the boy band stuff didn't feel accessible because you have to be very good looking and good at dancing. Not good at either of those things. But Bonehead did make it appear accessible because he had been a plasterer. And there's a bit in one of the Oasis films where, they have the big argument, I think, and Noel leaves the band after a gig in San Francisco, I think. And Bonehead said to Gwigsy, "God, should I just go back to being a plasterer?" And they're like, "Could I do that? Yeah, I probably could do it. I've had a break from plastering." And so that's very, very encouraging, because you think to yourself, wow, these are just normal people. And I think I can do that.
And I think there's, a very strong reasons about, with class behind that. They were very open, a lot of the Britpop bands came from comprehensive schools and they were quite open about their backgrounds. It wasn't, like you said, it felt much more accessible.
Yeah, and friends of mine were in a band and they put on a gig in the local church vestry because it was a space that they could hire for free. And they just played. And I remember going to watch that. And it was a bit weird seeing friends of mine on the stage. And obviously, because they were 14 or 15, it wasn't lit properly and there was no PA system. They just turned their amps up. But it was a sort of social event as well. I remember going to watch that and thinking, oh, this is good. This is exciting. And then you go back to trying to learn the guitar with renewed vigor. Well, my sister was learning the flute at school and I'd had a couple of piano lessons. I hadn't really got on with that. And I'd thought the music wasn't for me. And then I would look at my sister, and even though she was in the school orchestra, I was thinking, yeah, but you couldn't. Obviously, I hadn't heard Jethro Tull at that point or Focus. But yeah, obviously you can be in a band if you play the flute. But I didn't associate flute music, of playing the flute, with being in a band. I remember thinking, why would you want to do that when if you played a guitar, you could be in a group?
Sure.
And that'd be really exciting. So then there's just enormous enthusiasm.
So what were you listening to at this point when you're just starting to be in a band? Are we still sort of in Britpop world, or are you dabbling into slightly more niche genres?
It was Britpop and the Gorkies and the Super Furry Animals, and by this point, the Beatles. And I'd previously dismissed the Beatles because I thought it was mum and dad music. And then the Beatles anthology was on ITV when I was about 15. It all seemed to happen when I was 15, and I remember watching those with interest because I'd read so much about them and thought, this is probably significant. I should probably give this a watch. It's, a 6-episode documentary about the Beatles' career, and I was absolutely enthralled by it. I was just blown away, A, by the music, but also the story and their four personalities, all of the things that you can love the Beatles for. It's all on screen in 6 really brilliantly put together hours of a documentary. It was shown on ITV in November and December 1995. And so I used to tape them off the telly, and then I practically wore the video out. Like, I would just watch it again and again and again and again, and I can quote it verbatim the whole way through. And I bought it on DVD about 10, 15 years ago, and the DVD is extended scenes, which I hadn't realised. So there'd be an interview with George Harrison, which I'm mouthing along because I know every single syllable of what he says, And then there'd be a new bit. And I was like, what's happened to my memory? What's going on? Oh my God. I didn't realise that there was lots of extra stuff on the DVDs. Annoyingly, it's not available to stream the Beatles anthology. So you'd have to buy a hard copy from somewhere because it's such a shame. But it was an amazing piece of television because it introduced me to the band. It introduced me to the Stones. It introduced me to a load of music that they loved. It introduced me to the civil rights movement in America, a wider general history of the 1960s. So it was just all this culture. And when you're 15, you're a sponge, so you're just taking it all on. And I'm like, okay, wow, okay, I like this stuff.
So the Beatles sort of came back round for you. I mean, I definitely had the same thing growing up as well. You know, I grew up with a lot of Motown, but also a lot of like Rolling Stones and stuff like that. But and obviously when you're a kid, you sort of react against it. And then at some point in your life, you sort of come back and go like, oh no, this is actually good.
Yeah, absolutely. And surprisingly, my daughter doesn't seem to have reacted against my taste in music. She's sort of taken it on board. Whereas with my mum and dad, I was quite cynical about it. There was a lot of eye rolling and that kind of thing. And but with certainly with the Beatles, and then obviously you get to the Stones, and then you get to the Who, and then you get to the Small Faces and the Kinks, and there's such a wealth of talent from that era, and the records are still great. So then by that point, I'm a fully paid up obsessive music fan. I get The Enemy delivered to the house when I can afford it. I'm reading Q magazine, or if I can't afford it, I'm standing in WH Smith's and reading it from cover to cover, then putting it back and then moving on to Mojo and then being moved out of the shop by security, but all of that kind of stuff.
So by the time you're, you know, properly in a band and you're starting to play gigs, where is your music taste? Have we sort of moved on from that kind of era, or are other band members sort of handing you things, probably a CD at the time, of saying, put this in your Sony Discman?
I was into Radiohead. I really loved the Benz and OK Computer. The problem with OK Computer, though, was that something like Paranoid Android, for instance, isn't quite an odd time signature. So you think, all right, well, maybe not. So I was in a band when I was 17 or 18, and what we liked doing was annoying people. So it was very psychedelic and lots of feedback and recorders and backwards keyboards and stuff. Because obviously when you've grown up in West Wales, there's a scarcity of places to play. So like you'd end up playing in rugby clubs and things in front of the rugby team who are just standing there in their suits, drinking pints, just staring at you like, what the hell is this? So that was good fun. But then I stopped doing it when I was at university, and then I started another band when I was... I was asked to join another band when I was about 25. And that was really good fun, because the other three had all been in really serious groups. So Mike, who was the bassist, had been in a band called Moby Shopee, who were the second band to be signed to V2 after the Stereophonics, and they'd been Radio 1 Single of the Week. And then Gemma, the singer, she was in a really great group called Sammo Hung, who were asked to support Bloc Party and Franz Ferdinand and stuff. But then they split up at a really crucial time. But I used to really love Sammo Hung. And then our friend Moggs, who was the drummer, had been in one of the offshoot bands from McCluskey when McCluskey had split up. So the other three were really experienced and had been there and done it, and I hadn't. It was really fun, and I loved playing music, but you realise how committed all bands have got to be, because the amount of stuff you end up doing for nothing. And even when you're doing cool stuff, you're not getting paid very much. Like we did a Six Music session and stuff, and we supported The Fall.
Oh, wow. How was that?
Amazing. And, it was quite, we loved The Fall as, the four of us. And so that was a really big moment for us. We played Glastonbury, actually. We played the 2007 or 2008 Glastonbury. But the thing is, when we did the Six Music session, I think we got £350. Like, there was four of us in the group. It's not even 100 quid each. And as a teenager, I remember hearing bands saying, I remember listening to bands who might do an evening session. I assumed they were all multi-millionaires. Like, I genuinely thought, if you're on Radio 1, you've made it. You live in a castle. You've got a swimming pool. You've got a jacuzzi. You've probably got a chef. You're driving around Ferraris. It's just, it couldn't be further from the truth. And it was a very instructive time in that sense, because you realise there's a few bands at the top ruining an absolute fortune and everyone else is just trying their hardest to get by. And it made it appear a lot less glamorous, actually. I still loved writing songs. I still loved playing guitar and being in a band. But you think, oh, fuck, all the stuff I loved and have loved since I was about 14. Christ, this...
So you're like still like mid to late 20s at this point?
Mid to, yeah. So that band split up when I was about 27, I think. Because by that point, I was going full-time as a comic, so I couldn't really do both.
Ah, so was that the fork in the road for you? Was it kind of, there's one path here and there's another path here, and I need to pick one?
Because it's, you know, there are lots of, or there certainly were then, non-famous stand-up comics who earned a living. So I thought, well, I'm, you know, it looks like I'm going to be one of those. And that's fine by me. And I was going out with a singer and we split up. And then the other two, I think, I mean, it's a long time ago, but not now. But the thing with comedy was, as well, you're not dividing everything four ways. And you're not reliant on the other three's diaries, all that kind of stuff. And there's an awful, like, I hadn't realised until I was in a band that was being taken seriously, how much admin there is.
Yeah, I have no idea how bands function.
It blows my mind. Yeah.
I don't know how you get 3, 4, 5 people agreeing on that many things.
The Polyphonic Spree. How are they doing it?
How does that work?
There's about 50 of them.
Is it like a, you know, polling system of, you know, majority wins? I don't know.
I remember Video Now, that Welsh language music programme I was talking about earlier on. I remember seeing an interview with a musician, and I thought, you know, he was in a band. It wasn't him and the band, or just him with a group of backing musicians. It was a band with a band name, but he was the singer. And the presenter said, "Have you got any advice for aspiring bands?" And he said, You have to realise it's not a democracy. There has to be a boss and everyone listens to the boss and then that's the only way we'll function. I remember thinking, you know, yeah, okay, fair enough. And it's just, but it's the same with being in a sketch group, because I was in a sketch group. I was in a couple of sketch groups. But suddenly you're like, oh, well, I actually can't do that gig because I'm doing this. You know, well, if you're doing that, well, I'll do that. And then it's trying to bind everyone together is really difficult. And the reason bands get into trouble, I interviewed Dave Rowntree of Blur once, and they were famously, you know, they were declared bankrupt and there was all sorts of dodgy stuff going on. And Dave Rowntree was like, so I went to university and studied law because I thought, I will never allow this to happen to me again. And I need to be fully informed as to what's happening. The problem is most musicians don't think like that because they're not accountants or solicitors. They're musicians and they've gone into music because they love music and they're creative. And crucially, they wouldn't be very good accountants or musicians. I read into the Stereophonics years ago and they were like, we couldn't believe we would turn up at venues and there was loads of free beer and they would give us anything we wanted for. So then we were asking for whiskey and then we were asking for vodka and then we were asking for all sorts and then better whiskey. And we would invite all of our friends and there was always a party. And it wasn't until much later we realised that we were paying for it all. We were being sent a bill because that's how musicians think and that's why we love them. But it's why it's... I can understand why groups, when they fall apart, it can be quite acrimonious.
So at this point of your life where you're not playing in bands anymore and you're embarking on a solo career or, you know, or within a sketch group. So what kind of things are you listening to at this point of life? Sort of late 20s, early 30s?
In my late 20s, I really got into the Nuggets box set, which is American garage rock. And then I really got into Rubble, which is a big like 10 CD box set of English, or largely English or British first generation sort of psychedelia and freak beat. I was really, really into that. And I used to listen to, because at that point, when you're at that point of your stand-up career, you're just driving. You're just in the car all the time, driving to Leeds or Carlisle or whatever it is, or Scotland. So I just used to burn through those CDs. I mean, the Rubble, the interesting thing, say, with the Rubble compilation is that you will find a band like Fleur de Lis, who I'd never previously heard of, who were from Southampton. I think they released one album, one fantastic album. So you can buy it on, you know, they're available to stream, actually. But they had a couple of hits. They were from Southampton. They didn't last very long. But the music they made was amazing. But there's loads of these bands. It's like there's loads of great. That was the overriding thing behind like Northern Soul, was there's so many brilliant one-hit wonder soul songs and soul artists. And then you're looking for the most obscure ones. There's just amazing music out there. And I still lived in Cardiff at this point. So I remember I bought the Rubble CD box set from Spillers Records, which is still there in an amazing record shop. So I used to listen to a lot of, garage rock and 60s stuff at that time. But then, you know, I go through phases. So I went through a big post-punk phase as well, where I loved Gang of Four and groups like Dinosaur Jr. as well, and the slightly more American stuff, and Mishna Burma, people like that. And Wire, I was a big fan of Wire.
So on those long drives up and down the country from Cardiff, was that like a really useful moment for you to, you know, expand your taste in music, maybe pull away from the Britpop stuff into other genres?
I mean, the power of it is that it makes the journeys go so fast. Like if you're off stage in Leeds at 10 a.m., you're not really going to get back to Cardiff until 2 a.m. But if you've got a 10 CD box set of Freakbeat and first generation psychedelia to get through, that journey is going to fly by. And also when you start off as a stand-up, you have got time to go to record shops and discover new stuff. Like I wasn't streaming music at this point, and I wouldn't have been able to play it in the car anyway if I had been. But so I was still buying a lot of physical copies of things, you know, CDs usually. You know, I've not just stuck to the same stuff when it comes to my taste. Like I've always hung out with big music nerds, and it's fun hanging out with a music nerd who likes slightly different stuff to you, because usually there'll be some way of, you know, there'll be some crossover. So I'm now friends with a really brilliant jazz drummer, and he plays at Ronnie Scott's and stuff, and he's played on loads of records, and he will introduce me to stuff I've never heard before. In fact, I was at school with a big jazzer, two big jazzers who were big fans of jazz music. And they introduced me to one of my mates introduced me to a song called Blue Pepper by Duke Ellington, which I've played at Scared to Dance actually, because it's got such an immediate melody, even if you haven't heard it before. And most people, I would say, haven't. Within 30 seconds, you're like, okay, this is an absolute tune. And Johnny Owen, the filmmaker, he made Don't Take Me Home, the film about Wales at the 2016 Euros. And he starts that documentary with La Responsable by Jacques Dutronc. And within the first 15 seconds of hearing that, even though it's being played over footage of Wales losing, I was like, this is a tune. And I've played that at Scared to Dance as well. And again, if you haven't heard of Jacques Dutronc, you only need 10 seconds and you've immediately bought into it. So I've always, the thing with music is that, especially if you play an instrument, you feel in the back of your mind that there's a secret to be unlocked, right? So Bob Dylan thinks that all songs exist and you've just got to kind of pluck them out of the air. And I think the really great songwriters accept that there's sometimes just a magic and you can't really quantify it or qualify it. But if you're not blessed to be a great songwriter, hello, but you can play, and I can play piano a bit as well. You kind of think, but there must be, surely if I just study enough for the great songs, I'll finally work it out. So Keith Richards plays a lot of songs in open G. So I was tuning my guitar to open G the other day and I was messing about with it. And it all sounds a bit like shit Keith Richards, basically. And so I was messing about and you're like, okay, it's nominally the same as what he's doing, but he just makes it sound better. But you're like, I feel like I'm getting closer to unlocking music secrets. And for instance, if you're a joke writer, there are rules to writing jokes and there are techniques to writing jokes. But you can't, that doesn't legislate or allow for a really amazing imagination. And I think I'm, as someone who's a professional comedian, I think I find it slightly easier to sit back and just accept that some comedians are just blessed with something. Whereas with music, like I love Bert Jansch, right? So I've got a book of Bert Jansch tablature and I've learned to play four or five Bert Jansch songs, which are technically very tricky, but I've got there just by perseverance. So now I can play four or five and I'm looking at my fingers as I'm playing them and I'm like, it sounds great and it sounds, you know, as much like Bert Jansch as I could hope for. What am I learning from this? Will I ever unlock the key to Bert Jansch's music? And I'm like, no, I don't think I will actually. But it's very frustrating. I know I should call him Bert Jansch as well. That's an old habit I can't get out of, I'm afraid.
I mean, you talked about your DJing and, you know, your taste in music. I mean, there are certain songs that I can think of when you DJ. That's a really great thing about doing Scared to Dance is there are certain songs in my head that relate to certain guest DJs. Like Shirley Bassey is definitely one with you. The Human League. I think I remember you saying that Don't You Want Me is it undeniable? I think the phrase you said.
Yeah, it's undeniable and it's just so immediate.
So what are your favourite songs to play for those who may not have been at any of your guest DJ sets at the club?
Don't You Want Me by Human League. I always start with Tainted Love by Glory Jones, the original version. Because again, I think most people have heard the soft cell version. And then when they hear the Gloria Jones version, they know it so they can sing along to it. But it's just a completely different take and a completely different interpretation of that song. Obviously, you know, she wrote it. Gone with the Wind is My Love by Rita and the Tiaras.
I can think of the Flirtations as well.
Oh, Nothing But Heartache. Yeah. And the Flirtations, I think someone in the Flirtations is searching for their name on Twitter because I often say, off to do Scared to Dance. Can't wait to play Nothing But Heartache by the Flirtations. And I won't at them, but they will always like that tweet.
They've got their alerts turned on. For any
yeah, reason. Yeah. They definitely have got alerts turned on. And I think that the thing with, I would say Date with the Night by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs as well is another great song.
I mean, you did our film night where you chose Meet Me in the Bathroom, which was all about Yeah Yeah Yeahs and The Strokes.
Yeah, and The Rapture.
And The Rapture, yeah. LCD Sound System.
The funny thing with that is because that musical movement happened when I was probably 21 or 22, and then in England, it was the Libertines and Razor Light at the same time. I was in my early 20s. I just graduated. I was either at university or I just graduated. And when you graduate, if you go to university, if you decide to go to university, when you graduate, you end up almost feeling older than your years because you're like, well, I've done that now.
Yeah.
I'm an old man. I'm bloody 22. Oh, my God. And what was interesting was they really captured the imagination of people slightly younger than me. People, so I suppose, you know, the Strokes and the White Stripes and the Libertines, they were people who might be 5 years younger than I am. They were their Oasis and Blur. And a small part of me felt like going, yeah, I've kind of been here before, actually. In December 1996, I saw the Manic Street Preachers, Cat Tony, Super Free Animals, followed then a few months later by Radiohead, Blur, Pulp, Oasis, of course, and the Be Here Now. So, and I kind of felt a little bit like an old bloke.
Yeah.
And I wished, considering how young I was, I wish Absolutely. I'd completely jumped headfirst into that.
Yeah. I mean, that first Strokes album was just huge. I mean...
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you play any of those tunes at an indie night and people still lose their minds.
I mean, like Block Party seems to have sort of come back again. I think they're touring the first album at the moment, which I'm guessing is 20 years old. Is that right?
Oh my God, yes. I think it probably is. I had The Rapture on Six Music the day. It must have been part of cloud busting at breakfast. I was making toast for the kids and The Rapture came on. I turned it up. It was like ear-splittingly loud. Both kids are crying. You know, I'm in a dressing gown. I was like, this is an absolute tune. What a banger.
Yeah.
And I think I wish I'd been able to let that in a little bit more.
Mm.
Whereas I think now I actually have more enthusiasm. I think I'm less cynical now. Like I went to see Adwaith the other night and just thought, this is fantastic. And, you know, when a really great band comes along, you've got to take advantage of it because it doesn't happen very often. It's a bit like if the football team you support ends up with a good side, you've got to take advantage of it and go to all the games you can because it's probably not going to happen again.
Yeah, you know, it'll be fleeting, you know. Arsenal or Swansea might only be good for a season or two.
Make the most of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Ellis, bring things slightly more up to date. What was the last album you bought that you really, really loved?
The last album I bought was Solas by Adwaith, which I thought was exceptional. I loved Bill Ryder-Jones's album, Iechyd Da. I thought that was really, really fantastic. Very moving record. And also... such great melodies, and it's a really special album. Actually, I did Loose Ends to promote Fancy Football League. Me and Matt Lucas were on it, and he was the musical guest, and he played, and he was great. And then I bought the record as soon as it came out, and just thought it was a really, really, I thought it was a fantastic piece of work. Actually, I think he's a really, really gifted guy, and he did a sort of a double headline tour with Griff Rhys, and I was unable to go because I was on tour myself at the time, so I missed the gigs. They did the Barbican, I think, in London.
Yeah, that's right.
And I would have loved to see that. And I mean, it's an obvious choice, but I loved Romance, the last Fontaine's DC album.
Yeah,
where I saw them. They were the last gig I saw before lockdown at the Brixton Academy, and they've just kicked on now, and they're just stellar.
And this weekend that we're recording, the BBC website has... can you remember the name of the title of the article?
Man tries to find a link to any Welsh person who phones into radio show in 1 minute, which sounds like it was written by AI. The BBC Wales Today programme, which is the main Welsh news at 6:30, I think they're listeners in the newsroom. So I think I might have talked about whether it would be newsworthy or John had, you know... I don't know. I don't know how it came about, but they decided to do a feature on it because a random Welsh person will ring in the show and I've got 60 seconds to find a link to them, and I have an over 50% hit rate because of the nature of Welsh society and we're a small country. So they came up to London to film me doing it, and then I had to do it to the presenter. I got a link with her in 45 seconds because she was at school with someone who writes a fanzine I like. And it was... But then obviously that was on Wales Today, and I was really pleased with the piece. It really explains the show and it really explains the premise. I thought it was really well done. And I really like the news article as well. It's just a very funny headline.
It is.
Because it doesn't make me look like a presenter on a comedy podcast. It makes me look like a local loon who is just going up to people in the street and saying, right, you, do I know you? Was at school with your brother? And but in the news piece, in the news item, Robin says, you know, I have seen Ellis come reconnect in the wild, like at gigs. If anyone goes up to him at the stage door or something and they're Welsh, he will stand there and try and find a connection and won't really be satisfied until he's managed it. So it's just that. And it's just, that's something all Welsh people do on holiday and things. It's just that distilled into a radio feature. But I suppose that's the nature of Wales being a small country. For instance, Eros Childs, ex of the Gorkies, who's now in Teenage Fan Club, whose album that came out at the end of 2024, Beehive Beach, actually is a really brilliant record. I was at school with his mum. No. His mother taught with my mum and I was at school with him. So there's always these weird links. Like my history teacher was friends with Griff Rees from the Super Furry Animals. So then I would watch them. And even though they grew up in North Wales, I grew up in South West Wales, I would watch them. And I think, oh my God, my history teacher knows them. It's just, it's a small place and, yeah. and it lends itself to that kind of thing. You could definitely do the Irish connection on Irish radio if you wanted. And I think that would be very entertaining. I should franchise it.
You should.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, are you surprised with how much it's blown up? Because I'm aware that, you know, it's got a lot of traction on TikTok and Instagram and so on. You know, people that don't listen to the radio show have become aware of it.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm not on TikTok. I've never been on TikTok, but people tell me it's apparently popular on TikTok. And people do really like it. What I find funny is I don't actually think John does like it. But when you get emails from people saying, I would love to see this live at Wembley Stadium, you have to accept that it's popular with the listeners. I just can't.
Is it like your FA Cup final every 2 weeks?
Yes. So if I fail, I'm genuinely down for a long time afterwards. And if we're recording and I've got a jumper on, or if I've got like an overshirt on, I've got to take it all off because I get so hot and bothered. That's genuine. And so we'll have to do Cymru Connection as a sort of finale, because otherwise the whole gig could be either derailed, or it'll go on to be the best gig of all time, just because I'm sort of buzzing and full of joy.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time, Ellis, and it was a pleasure talking to you about your musical history. And we hope to see you at Scared to Answer again in the future.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to Ellis James for joining me today. Be sure to check out his show on BBC Sounds alongside his many other podcasts. Coming up at Scared to Dance, we are back at the Shackle Arms on Saturday the 21st of February with guest DJing from Lime Garden. Tickets are selling quickly on Dice. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back for Season 2 of the Scared to Dance podcast later this year. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a review and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For all of our upcoming events, you can follow us on social media at Scared to Dance. This podcast was produced at Third Floor Recording.